From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, the Canadian military shops for surveillance drones that can kill.
The government is thinking about this not just in the context of beneficial operations. Police in Canada are increasingly incorporating things like facial recognition technologies into their work, right? And when you couple that with domestic surveillance drones, things can get really scary.
The Canadian government slaps sanctions on a Russian discussion group. Who's disinforming whom?
The level of mendacity of our governments, particularly the Canadian government, vis-a-vis Russia, knows no bounds. Where is the disinformation? The disinformation is in the Western media. In the Western media, you have only wall-to-wall disinformation about Russia.
And a Canadian anti-imperialist calls on real leftists to challenge fake peaceniks on the right.
It's time for us on the left to stand up and be true to our principles, our anti-imperial, anti-war, anti-militarist principles, and re-seize the mantle of peace from these fake peaceniks on the right.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving into the polemics, help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Imagine this scenario. A G20 summit is taking place near Quebec City. Protesters will be there. Among these, anti-capitalists vowing to disrupt the summit, exploiting the presence of international media to further their radical cause. Wise to their aims, the Canadian Air Force launches an unmanned surveillance drone. Severe storms are on the horizon. The drone flies to the summit through restricted airspace under military and air traffic control. Loitering over the noisy protesters, the drone confirms there are no threats, but beams back lots of photos to national defense controllers. Here's another scenario. The same drone takes off from a runway west of Kandahar in Afghanistan. A high payoff target has been spotted beside a road where an alliance convoy will soon be traveling. So the drone is armed with an AGM-114 Hellfire missile and a pair of 250-pound GBU-48 laser-guided bombs. The drone spots three fighting-aged males. Zooming in, operators back in Canada spot a shovel and disturbed earth nearby. Circling for a closer look, they spot a wire coming from that patch of disturbed soil near the three fighting-aged males. One of them appears to be holding a radio or cell phone. He and his friends are clearly combatants, legal agencies and controllers back in Canada conclude. They authorize the use of force, and the three men are liquidated. These two imaginary scenarios were contained in a request for proposals issued by the Canadian Department of National Defense back in 2016. Canada is in the market for a fleet of drones that can perform these tasks for real. Two weapons firms put in offers. Quebec-based L3Harris produces Israeli-style Heron drones. The American one markets Predator 2.0. The GPM spoke about Canada's future drone fleet with Matt Korda. Korda is a Canadian researcher at the Federation of American Scientists in Washington, D.C. That's where I reached him. Hello, Matt Korda. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me about these drones that Canada is about to procure.
Yeah, so the drone program in Canada has existed in sort of some shape or form since about 2005. The Royal Canadian Air Force, sort of at that time, they formally stood up this project office to develop the set of military requirements for procuring a drone, right? So whenever you want to procure a system, you have to sort of establish what your operational requirements are, and then you go out and you do your sort of sourcing and try and find out, okay, which system meets these particular requirements. So that was what they did, you know, in around 2005, and they sort of honed those requirements over the next decade, right? They did a lot of consultations with allies. At one point, they actually leased several drones from Israel to sort of conduct surveillance and targeting operations in Afghanistan.
What sorts of drones did they lease from Israel?
It was the Heron. So it's one whose sort of successor was, up until quite recently, on the procurement block for this new drone project, but then they actually dropped out quite recently. So we're actually, Canada is going to move in a different direction and go with a sort of a US-based drone instead.
And we're going to get back to that in a second, but this is interesting. I suspect this is not something that a lot of Canadians are aware of, that Canada leased Israeli Heron drones for use by Canadian forces in Afghanistan.
Yeah, so, you know, it was part of, my understanding, you know, surveillance operations, right? But it also sort of helps the armed forces just get their feet wet with using this type of platform, right? So then, you know, when they go out and now are trying to figure out what drone Canada actually wants to buy, there are folks who have sort of worked with those drones in the past who have spoken quite glowingly about them from their perspective and said, okay, well, we had a good experience with them, you know, in Afghanistan, maybe we'll sort of go with the successor. Yeah, but that, you know, as I guess we'll get into that, they've sort of dropped out of that competition now. So now we're sort of moving in a different direction.
And those Israeli drones that Canada had leased for use in Afghanistan were manufactured by a Quebec company?
That's a good question. I'm actually not sure where the subcomponents come from. I do know a lot of these various companies, they have contractors that sort of exist all over Canada, right? So there's subcomponents that are manufactured in places like London, right, in Quebec. And so as we'll sort of see when we talk about the system that Canada is likely to, at this point, is probably almost certain to procure, it does have a lot of local manufacturing. And, you know, when we think about things like the sensors and things like that, these are all manufactured locally in Canada.
But the Quebec company that was in the race to provide the Canadian Air Force with drones that ended up dropping out, that was a Quebec company, as I understand. And its drone was something that was based, am I wrong, on the Israeli Heron drone?
Oh, yes. So there have effectively been two drone teams that have been competing for this contract. There's one called Team Sky Guardian, right? And that's led by General Atomics.
In the States.
Yeah, exactly. And then Team Artemis is the one that is led by L3Harris and Israel Aerospace Industries, right? So the latter team, that's the one that there is some Canadian representation, but it's sort of based on this Israeli successor technology. But that company or that sort of team dropped out of the bidding process very recently. So effectively, there's only one team left, Team Sky Guardian, and that's almost certainly going to become the drone program that Canada goes for. So Team Artemis is the one that dropped out.
And why did they drop out?
It's a little unclear. Companies do sort of enter and exit bidding wars all the time, right? Sometimes they find it's not worth their time, right, to participate in this particular program. And, you know, they move on to a different program where perhaps the contracts are more lucrative. The reporting that I've seen is it's a little unclear why they did drop out. But all we know is that we have, you know, there's one team left.
Tell me about that team and their proposal and the acquisition that Canada is going to make.
Yeah, so the Team Sky Guardian, right, they're offering a version of their drone that's called the MQ-9B, right? So that's primarily in use with the U.S. military. And that particular drone is capable of carrying laser-guided missiles, Hellfire missiles, precision-guided munitions. It's capable of doing surveillance and various intelligence reconnaissance operations. It's kind of the standard American drone, right? When you think about drones in the context of the U.S. military, like, this is the drone that we're usually talking about.
And is that the latest version of the Reaper drone?
I believe so.
So, okay, so tell me about this acquisition. Is this...
It is the Reaper. Yeah, sorry. You're right.
It is the Reaper. Are General Atomics and their Sky Guardian latest version of the Reaper drone good to go? Is Canada going to acquire these? And how many and for how much and where does it stand?
Yeah, so very likely Canada will be acquiring these. It's a little unclear still how many. I'm not sure that even, you know, the Canadian procurement agencies even know how many of these systems they're planning on acquiring. That being said, what we have seen is that as recently as September, the U.S. Defense Security Cooperation Agency, which sort of governs to some extent foreign military sales, they gave a statement that suggested that the U.S. perhaps might sell a series of equipment to Canada that is basically equipment specifically designed for these drones, right? So the things that they were talking about were synthetic aperture radars, Hellfire missiles, particular types of bombs that tend to be incorporated onto those drones. So basically what you can sort of glean from that is that even though Canada hasn't made an official decision yet on what type of drone that they're planning on purchasing, the fact that there's only one team left and that team is essentially a sort of a US-based team, and the US is already sort of moving ahead with assessing a possible transfer to Canada of equipment for that particular drone, that sort of indicates to me that this is very likely the system that Canada is going to procure.
How much does one of these drones cost?
Yeah, so what Canada has assessed is that the program is likely to cost between $1 and $5 billion, right? That's how much the entire project is going to cost.
Canadian dollars?
Yes.
So between $1 and $5 billion Canadian dollars?
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
And it's unclear, you know, how that gets dispersed, right, in terms of how much is the unit cost for a particular drone versus the entire program and the maintenance and, you know, the operations and the acquisition. But that's what they've estimated, right? When you go on the government website, that's the range that they add.
These would be armed with missiles. These would come along with, just like your printer comes along with printer cartridges, this drone would come along with Hellfire missiles.
Yeah, the equipment for the drone would likely come in a separate military sale, right? So that would likely cost additional funds, right? And that's why we've sort of seen these like foreign military sales sort of start to get reported on. But the system itself, right, is the $1 to $5 billion, and then we're likely to see a little bit more than that probably.
How are these things operated? Like they're operated from a given facility somewhere in Canada,
yeah.
Assuming once they're procured, there'd be a team that would operate these drones from some well-fortified secret facility within Canada?
Pretty much.
How many people would it take to run a system like this, and they'd operate them by remote control?
Yeah, I'm not certain of the exact numbers of folks, but certainly like we can learn a lot about how the system is going to be operated based on how the United States operates its drones, right? And there's quite a lot of, you know, although that is a secret program, right, there's been a lot of reporting on how the US does operate its drones and what missions and target sets it's been used for. A lot of that reporting has revealed, I think, some pretty disturbing potential deployment scenarios that, you know, Canada could potentially be implicated in. And, you know, one thing that is quite notable is that when Canada put out its RFP, right, its request for proposals to provide a framework for companies to bid on the program, it included a lot of fictional but realistic scenarios to convey mission priorities to industry. It provides basically these seven scenarios, and they say, all right, well, we need a drone, right? And we need a drone to be able to do these seven different types of missions. And so they actually provide an almost, it's literally a minute by minute account of how the drone would be used in context with those different scenarios. You know, some of these are very benign, right? It'll be like a search and rescue mission in the Arctic, or perhaps a training mission for the Canadian Air Force. And then some of them are actually quite alarming, right? So for example, one of them is what the government calls a domestic overland ISR sortie, right? ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. And what they describe is, they describe the scenario that says, you know, a drone is going to be tasked to support RCMP security operations at a fictional G20 summit that's held near Quebec City. And the drone's surveillance mission is to sort of watch the protest and see what's going on, record data of the crowd, and then report threatening activities to the RCMP. And then the scenario sort of notes in its preamble, it has some kind of a, you know, what I would perceive to be sort of a bit of a red flag, right? So it says, you know, several groups have openly indicated their intent to protest, and intelligence indicates that radical elements may exploit the presence of international media to further their anti-capitalist cause by disrupting the summit.
Is this a quote? Is this an actual quotation?
That is an actual quotation, right? So that's from this government procurement document that says, here's why we need these drones, right? Here's an example of a scenario. We have these anti-capitalists and they want to disrupt the G20. So we need a drone to go out and surveil them. And then it provides a timeline for how the drone actually gets used. I have like a few notes here that I think are really interesting. The drone operators observe this car that's parked in a field, and they use infrared sensors to assess that the engine is warm. And then they report the car's location to the kind of on-the-ground security team. And then the security team goes to investigate, and they see that the occupants are some underage teenagers who are drinking. And then they hand them over to the police. And then the drone operators kind of continue to do their surveillance, and they spot another vehicle that's driving towards the summit. and they get a security team to go intercept it. And they find that the car that was driving had these sort of anti-capitalist radicals that the sheet was talking about, and they were going to hang a banner about climate change.
You're serious? This is an actual scenario that was in writing?
That is an actual scenario.
Written by National Defense, Canadian National Defense people.
It is, yeah. So these are scenarios that are presented by the government to industry to convey the types of situations in which they would want their drones to operate. And so there's another scenario that I found, you know, even more disturbing. That one is kind of a domestic surveillance operation within Canada. This one is an actual military operation outside of Canadian soil. And it takes place in Afghanistan. And basically the drone operators, they spot what they call fighting age males on a road. And that term is particularly a red flag for me because there has been so much reporting on the American drone program and their use of the term fighting age males to essentially mean any male over the age of, you know, 16 or 18, who's just in the wrong place at the wrong time, right? And that's been used as an excuse to potentially assassinate those individuals, right? And so the drone operators in this instance, they spot three fighting age males on a road and they see a wire on the ground and one of them is holding a cell phone. And the use of force is then subsequently authorized and the drone operators launch a precision guided munition at the three men because they have been labeled as combatants, right? So that's a situation that is in this document as a potential use case for these drones, right? And that to me raises a lot of red flags.
Any other domestic scenarios, Canadian domestic scenarios that you recall? No environmental protests, no anti-logging protests?
No, not that I saw. There were others that to me seem more benign, right? So, you know, one was about conducting a search and rescue operation in the Arctic. And, you know, if that's something that if it can help with search and rescue operations, then I think that's actually, that's useful, right? But clearly this is something that has a lot of different purposes. The government is thinking about this, not just in the context of, I think, beneficial operations, and also, you know, thinking about it very much in terms of how the Americans use their drones, right? Which I don't think is a model that Canada should be thinking about when we think about our drone operations, right? We should not be using these to surveil domestic protests or populations, and we shouldn't be using them to use them in the context of military operations abroad either.
Now, these are drones that can both loiter and fly?
Yeah. They do sort of loiter and fly around at, you know, at relatively low-ish altitudes.
So one of these drones, if Canada were to obtain a fleet of these drones, they would have to be based, I mean, some would be based in Canada, some would be based where outside of Canada's borders, right? I mean, Canada, I guess, has various military bases, not as many as the United States is. Where would these be based?
It's unclear, right? I don't think there's a good sense at this time of where these would be based, right? I think, you know, presumably for all domestic operations and things like that, they'd be based here. The question is, yeah, would, you know, is there some other base abroad that would allow the use of these, you know, for Canada? And I'm not sure that has sort of come out in the reporting yet.
Now, of course, the danger with weapons technologies is that once you procure these weapons technologies, military forces want to use them.
Yes, absolutely.
There's reason to use them. If there's something you'd like to do, but you don't have the technology to do it well, you just pass over that one. But if you happen to have a drone, an armed drone with Hellfire missiles, you got a dozen or two dozen of them, and some situation comes up somewhere in Canada or anywhere, somebody's going to say inevitably, let's deploy these.
Yeah. This is, I think, part of the reason why it's so disturbing to me that the documents seem to mirror so closely how the United States uses its drones. Because when we look at during the past few years, there have been these massive protests, right? Street protests in the United States for Black Lives Matter and for other types of domestic or social issues. And there have been instances in which police forces have deployed drones to surveil these crowds. And there have been, you know, congressional inquiries into this, or at least at the very least, individual Congress people asking, why is it that these drones were being used to surveil people doing essentially peaceful protests on U.S. soil? And so it certainly makes me very nervous to see what the outcry was, seeing that in the States, but then seeing that Canada is actually thinking about using their drones in a very similar capacity. And certainly, like, I take your point. I think you're completely right that this is often the case when it comes to military technology, right? And certainly it's the case when it comes to nuclear weapons, right? This is veering a little bit more into the work that I do on a day-to-day basis. But what we often see is that countries, they build systems, not necessarily because they have a, you know, a really clear place in their military doctrines, but they build them for a variety of other factors, right? Domestic reasons, financial incentives, you know, as technology demonstrators. And then later, once they're built, then they figure out how to work them into their doctrines, right? And then often it sort of becomes a situation where, all right, well, if you have, you know, this hammer, then everything looks like a nail, right? But countries aren't often thinking in advance about, okay, well, what is this problem that we can't solve? And is this the right system to do it? There are often a lot of other reasons at play for why countries build the things that they do.
And one can well imagine, I brought up this scenario, which I understand from what you're saying, wasn't one of the seven theoretical scenarios, but imagine some blockade, environmentalist or First Nations blockade against a logging operation somewhere in some really remote location in Alberta, say, and it's just a whole lot easier to send an armed surveillance drone to that site and take action because somebody's got their finger on the trigger.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Like, just as we've seen the extremely just harsh and violent responses to particularly Indigenous land defenders in Canada by the RCMP and, you know, by police forces, I'm sure that if there were these types of capabilities that they were able to use to be able to shut down some of those types of protests, I don't see why they wouldn't reach for them, right? You know, we're seeing that police in Canada are increasingly incorporating things like facial recognition technologies into their work, right? And when you couple that with domestic surveillance drones, things can get really scary, right? You very, very quickly.
Matt Korda, I asked you this already, where this stands at the moment, but are you looking ahead at milestones, steps, stages with dates associated with them, timelines that give you a sense of when Canada is actually going to make a decision about procuring these and when they'd actually be part of the Canadian military arsenal?
Yeah, so the contract is expected to be awarded sometime next year, right, in 2024. I think the expectation is that this, you know, Team Sky Guardian with these American-style drones is going to be the sort of the winner because they're at this moment the only bidder. First delivery of these drones is supposed to be in 2026. And then full operational capability is expected by the early 2030s, right? So, you know, it's possible that some will be in use before then, maybe like a limited number. I'm sure, you know, there will have to be a lot of training and certification by, you know, whoever the operators are going to be that's associated with that. But we're sort of looking at, you know, 2026 for first delivery and then actually incorporating these, you know, fully into the military by sort of, you know, the end of the decade or early 2030s.
How much awareness would you say there is in the Canadian media about this? I know, I believe this was reported in the Ottawa Citizen, if I'm not mistaken. I seem to recall that. How widely known is this in the Canadian media and amongst Canada's, you know, professed peace-loving opposition parties? How widely known is this procurement or planned procurement?
It's a good question. I'm certainly not aware of a particularly large, you know, sort of public outcry over this. I think, you know, folks who are aware of it, I think are quite disturbed by it, but I haven't seen particularly strong messaging coming out from really any of the parties. That being said, I could just, you know, I could be missing something certainly, but it seems like, you know, folks are sort of preoccupied with other issues at the moment. But I think, you know, it's important to note that even those other issues that they're preoccupied with, adding in drones to these already existing frustrations in Canada, right? Overspending on police and, you know, facial recognition, those kinds of things that people, I think, are understandably very frustrated about. The addition of drones is going to make that problem a lot worse. So I would hope that the parties start to take this up a little bit more and sort of incorporate it into their vision of what they would like to see money get used for.
Matt Korda, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Matt Korda is a research fellow at the American Federation of Scientists in Washington, D.C. We'll link to a copy of the Canadian government's drone shopping list and specs at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Times of war, truth is the first casualty. So said the ancient Greek tragedian Aeschylus. In Western democracies today, it is the responsibility of intellectuals to speak the truth and to expose lies. Noam Chomsky said that. The GPM sat down for a lengthy discussion about truth and lies in times of war with two of its favorite guests. Radhika Desai is professor in the Department of Political Studies and director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group at the University of Manitoba. Dimitri Lascaris is a Canadian lawyer, journalist, and activist based in Montreal and Greece. Hello, Radhika Desai and Dimitri Lascaris. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Thanks for having us, David.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you, David.
Let's get into word games. Reading The Guardian the other day, November 3rd, this is a direct quote from The Guardian. Hezbollah, like Hamas, is a proxy of Iran. One never reads about Israel being a proxy of the United States. Egypt or Jordan are never described as proxies of the United States. And of course, Israel isn't. Talk about this. Hezbollah and Hamas are proxies of Iran, but not Israel. Israel's not a proxy.
If I may, Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid and military aid by far in history. Israel receives, on an ongoing basis, $3.8 billion a year. I've said many times that in many ways, Israel is a giant U.S. military base masquerading as a country. Look what the United States did as soon as this current round of violence erupted. It sent two aircraft carrier battle groups to the Eastern Mediterranean, putting at risk American forces for the benefit of Israel, an apartheid state. So if you're going to mount an argument that somebody is a proxy of some other greater power, I think the strongest argument is that Israel is a proxy of the United States. When it comes to Hezbollah and Hamas, these are two very different organizations, and having shared interests, having overlapping objectives, and of course, the defeat of Israel's apartheid regime is an objective that is shared by all three of them, Hezbollah, Iran, and Hamas, doesn't necessarily make you a proxy. Now, it's clear, that being said, that Hezbollah is heavily supported by Iran. To what extent Iran actually controls Hassan Nasrallah, I don't know. But clearly, there is a tremendous relationship there, which takes the form of, you know, supplying military weaponry, economic aid, and so forth from Iran to Hezbollah. I think the connection with respect to Hamas is less clear. Hard to imagine that Iran is able to provide the levels of support to Hamas because of the blockade that it provides to Hezbollah. But at the end of the day, what is this argument all about? I mean, if we're going to talk about proxies, as I said at the outset, the most obvious proxy in this conflict is Israel. It's a proxy of the United States, quite clearly.
But I mean, I think that the meaning of this term proxy, the supposition, not the supposition, but the obvious implication is that a proxy is a cat's paw. A proxy is some entity that has no authenticity. It possesses no agency of its own. It has no historical roots or authenticity. And so by saying that Hezbollah and Hamas are proxies of Iran is to say that they're just tools. They have no agency. They have no authenticity of their own, whereas Israel does.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, a proxy is basically someone who acts for somebody else. That's the legal definition of proxy. And I agree with you that to call Hamas or Hezbollah proxies of Iran is in that sense denying their autonomy, which is very real in many ways. But let me harp on proxies of the United States, because the United States has been waging proxy wars, conducting proxy assassinations, and essentially conducting proxy forms of sabotage and proxy revolutions all over the world, whether it is against the Nicaraguan regime through the Contras, whether it is against the Afghan government and Russia's support for it with the Mujahideen and the Taliban, and so on. there are today operating around the world thanks to the existence of the National Endowment for Democracy and other such outfits, proxies of the United States trying to foment regime change, secession, etc., in what would otherwise be quite stable and even beneficial regimes around the world. So really, the calling these outfits Hamas and Hezbollah proxies of Iran is simply really a form of projection. It is shameful. It is shame on the media today that it so cooperates in the decontextualization that allows these accusations to do their work, even among the small number of people in the world among whom these accusations become effective. The fact of the matter is the world is essentially waking up to the fact that the United States is engaged in a completely illegitimate, and by the way, I should add, I mean, I'll let Dimitri go on this, but illegal in international law forms of activity all around the world.
Before you jump in, Dimitri, I'd say, you know, by calling Hamas or Hezbollah proxies, what you're saying is that they have no legitimate grievances. They're just carrying out the will of some powerful patron, you know, who's moving them on the chessboard. Dimitri?
It certainly amounts to delegitimizing their grievances, right? You are, as you suggested, David, by calling them a proxy, denying their agency. I don't think in any situation where we have a proxy, I mean, certainly none of the major sort of proxy conflicts that we've seen, there's a completely bright line between being a proxy and being an actor, an independent actor. There are degrees of independence. You know, is there a degree of dependence between Hezbollah and Iran? Sure. But does that mean that Hezbollah exercises no autonomy, that it has no legitimate grievances of its own? I think that my sense of, I watched and listened very carefully to Hassan Nasrallah's speech. My sense of the man and of the leadership of Hezbollah, whatever you may think of the organization, is that they are actually quite concerned about how a full-scale war is going to affect the supporters of Hezbollah, the fighters of Hezbollah, and the people of Lebanon, quite independently of what Iran may want. I would be very surprised if that is not influencing their behavior to a very significant degree. And I'm sure that the same is true of Hamas, wherever it may be deriving its support. And again, whatever you may think of Hamas, I can't imagine that the leaders of Hamas aren't weighing carefully to some degree how their decisions and their actions are going to impact their movement within Gaza and within the occupied Palestinian territories, and how these are going to impact the people of Gaza. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to make necessarily the most humane decisions or the right decisions, but to suggest that these people, the leaderships of these two organizations, are not influenced by factors and concerns that are particular to their people and their constituents, I think is detached from reality.
There's this very dramatic tension emerging between the will of global civil society to go out in the street and protest in Berlin and in Toronto and Amsterdam and Rotterdam and New Delhi, all around the world. And on the other hand, the response of certainly Western governments to suppress protest and free speech. And I want to point out the head of Florida State University system ordering campus chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine to be shut down under apparent directive from Governor DeSantis. A soccer player of Arab or Muslim background has been suspended from the German football team because of statements that he made on social media. In France and in Germany, protests being banned. Sarah Jama, her expulsion from the Ontario NDP caucus for having expressed solidarity with Palestine. What's your understanding of this confrontation between the will of global civil society to express support for Palestine and the will of Western nations to block that? What's going to happen?
Well, what's going to happen is that this will be another, I would say, very big and important chapter in demonstrating the disconnect between Western leaders who are essentially the agents of a plutocracy and the ordinary people of Western countries, who, you will remember, are today a very mixed bunch. There are among them all sorts of minorities, including Jewish minorities, but also including Muslim minorities. And so I would say that this disconnect is going to manifest itself more and more clearly. But may I also say one other thing about the proxy issue? You know, everybody knows that the United States thinks of its proxy war against Russia, with Ukraine as a proxy, in terms of China as well, where presumably it seeks to use Taiwan as a proxy against China. Now, I think the Taiwanese are beginning to wise up to this, and they will be, and it'll be good if they do. But what would be the analogy in the Middle Eastern region? It would be that they will use Israel as a proxy to fight Iran. I think this is something that should make everybody who is in the region and everybody who is in Israel quake in their shoes.
Well, I think we're seeing an absolutely unprecedented level of censorship in the West. And I'll just give one example. There's a bill, I understand, before the Assemblée Nationale in France, which would impose potentially a penalty of 2 years imprisonment or a fine of 75,000 euros on anyone who, quote unquote, insults the state of Israel. Now, we've seen legislation like this in plenty of countries where the head of state of that country or the government of that country was being insulted, allegedly. Here, what France is doing is they are going to punish people severely, potentially, for insulting a foreign state. This is unprecedented. And I have two comments about this. I've always maintained that the severity of a censorship regime is directly proportional to the horrors that that regime is trying to conceal. The reason why we are seeing unprecedented levels of censorship in the West with respect to condemnations of Israel and Palestinian solidarity is because the horrors that they are now trying to conceal are so mind-boggling. That's the first thing I want to say about this. And the second thing is, this is years in the making. You know, I and others on the left have been complaining for years that the censorship that some people on the left in the progressive community were supporting. So, for example, during the pandemic, even though I myself was largely in agreement with the measures taken by the government to deal with that public health emergency, I did not agree that they should be censoring members of the medical profession who had dissenting views. I did not agree during the war, the proxy war in Ukraine, that people who were criticizing the West's support for Ukraine and saying that there's some legitimacy to what the Russians are saying about this war, that they should be censored. And I was saying very loudly and clearly, even if I disagreed with somebody, we on the left should not be supporting censorship because it will be turned upon us. And that's exactly what's happening now. The chickens are coming home to roost. And I hope all those people in the left and the progressive community over the last several years who were cheerleading censorship will now realize that that was a terrible mistake.
You brought up Ukraine, of course, and we're moving towards a discussion of Ukraine. It's interesting and not very surprising that Ukraine is now, well, I wouldn't say totally out of the news, but it's been kind of eclipsed, the Ukraine conflict. And I was watching Al Jazeera today and seeing that it's at a, apparently the word term stalemate has been used to describe the situation in Ukraine. And I gather that Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, has just paid a visit to Kyiv and has been visiting Volodymyr Zelensky and trying to provide him with some encouragement that there is a pathway to joining NATO, and you know, arms shipments will continue to flow, even though now the U.S. is really, really strapped. And it's fascinating that Republicans are trying to now, you know, pass this legislation that would send a mind-blowing $14 billion, earmark $14 billion for Israel, but nothing for Ukraine, because the Republicans, the MAGA Republicans, they don't like to support Ukraine. You have to laugh to keep from crying sometimes. Radhika?
Well, Ukraine war has been unpopular in the United States for quite a long time, as it has been in other European capitals. And in fact, by the way, the Ukraine war has been lost by the West for some considerable time. The term stalemate is still a euphemism in the present context. So what we are witnessing is a situation in which the West will have lost, but the loss cannot be admitted, because the moment you admit the loss, then you are held. The leaders in power, President Biden, Olaf Scholz, Mrs. von der Leyen, etc., are left holding the can. They will be blamed for pursuing this completely unreasonable war beyond the point where it could be won. That's the first thing. The second thing is, of course, that, yes, I think that the rest of the world continues to recognize the legitimacy of Russia's concerns. And I would say that current events in Israel, Gaza, etc., are going to further reinforce the conviction that is widely that exists in the world, that what the United States is doing is completely illegitimate, and this will extend itself to Ukraine. So, yes, President Zelensky is now apparently quite alone. Time magazine has published a story in which he is quoted as saying, "Nobody believes in Ukraine's victory as much as I do." Nobody does. That is to say, only he is left essentially trying to pursue this war. And by the way, he needs to pursue this war because the funding that Ukraine is getting is actually as much for fighting the war, whatever it is, you know, whatever weapons he's getting, and the capacity of the West to supply weapons is also exhausted. But it is also for keeping Ukraine going day to day. And there too, the money that is flowing to Ukraine, as everybody knows, given the level of corruption in the Ukraine government, is not necessarily going to ordinary Ukrainians. It is also being pocketed by the likes of Zelensky, who are themselves exceedingly rich personally.
Look, I think that what we're seeing in the Republican Party, the wing of the Republican Party that is opposed to further funding, what we're seeing in, for example, Germany, where the AfD is soaring in the polls, I think in large part due to the fact that it wants to bring an end to this proxy war and the funding of Ukraine. What we're seeing is the populist right is exploiting public sentiment, where the left should be stepping into the breach. The anti-imperialist, pro-peace left. And because we failed to do that, and I'm going to harp on this, too many people on the left, too many people in the progressive community supported this depraved proxy war. I and Radica and many others have been saying for months that this was going to end up in a devastating defeat for Ukraine, and that's exactly where we were. Not because we're military geniuses, but because anybody who was looking at the evidence in an objective, dispassionate manner could see that that is where this was heading. Obama himself said when he was the president that Russia has escalation dominance in this theater of conflict. We knew that this was going to end in the defeat of Ukraine. And we on the left, too many of us, didn't have the moral courage, frankly, to stand up and say that this was not being done in the interests of the Ukrainian people and it was potentially going to cause a nuclear conflict. And so what has happened now? Now you have people on the right who have the political acumen to see that there's a void there, stepping in and filling the void. They're doing it in the United States. They're doing it in Germany. They're doing it elsewhere. And it's time for us on the left to stand up and be true to our principles, our anti-imperial, anti-war, anti-militarist principles, and re-seize the mantle of peace from these fake peaceniks on the right.
You know, at the end of September, correct me if I'm wrong, Radica Desai, it was at the end of September that you went to Russia, to Sochi, to attend the annual gathering of the Valdai Discussion Club, and then found out after, I think, returning home that the Valdai Discussion Club is actually sanctioned by the Canadian government. And I went in to the Canadian government website and found, of course, that, amongst scores and scores of individuals and government institutions and departments and ministries and rich people and others, newspapers, magazines, cultural institutions, referred to as Russian-Moldovan disinformation agents peddling Russian disinformation and propaganda. And the Valdai Discussion Club is in there, of course. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this idea that the Canadian government could declare a discussion club, an annual academic gathering of politicians and academics engaging in discourse, free discourse with international visitors as propaganda so vile and dangerous that it's got to be sanctioned. This kind of blows my mind. I mean, a discussion club.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, let me clarify one small thing. I knew before I went to Sochi that Valdai had just been sanctioned. A few days before we were to leave for Sochi, we received a message from the Valdai Club saying, we have just heard that your government has sanctioned us. We would understand if you do not wish to come. So Alan and I, my husband and I, we sat down, we read the sanctions law, we consulted friends of ours, including Dimitri, obviously speaking in a completely informal capacity, and Dimitri was not the only one. We read the law very closely and we decided to go because we did not feel that the sanctions applied to us. That's the first thing. The sanctions do not, the way in which they are worded is actually very interesting, but they do not apply to attending a conference. Yes, we were aware that if the government wanted, they could harass us with a frivolous lawsuit. This was a possibility, but then we were willing to take that risk. And the reason we wanted to go there is also the reason why Dimitri went some months ago to Russia on his own. It is important to keep up a people-to-people dialogue. Alan and I have decades of contact with Russia. We work with several different groups of Russian scholars and activists and so on. And so we absolutely wanted to go. We were going to be in Valdai. We were going to meet many friends there. And of course, we have participated in Valdai before. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that, you know, the level of mendacity of our governments, particularly the Canadian government, vis-a-vis Russia, knows no bounds. Not only do they want to sanction all sorts of cultural and educational institutions, calling them instruments of disinformation, which is simply a form of projection, because where is the disinformation? The disinformation is in the Western media. In the Western media, you have only wall-to-wall disinformation about Russia. And where does it come to? We are deplatforming Russian composers, Russian writers, you know, Dostoevsky or Tchaikovsky, in a way that I don't think we did when the Western world was fighting Nazis. We didn't do that to German culture. So essentially, our governments have lost all sense of proportion. And the sanctions are not there actually to prevent business taking place between Canadians and Russians, because there are loopholes like the size of black holes, basically, in those sanctions laws, which allow all sorts of business to continue. All sorts of Canadian companies are continuing to do business. And what's more, the sanctions are there essentially for the government to harass people and generally to intimidate people. The idea is that if you read Valdai's sanction, you will refuse to go, and you should refuse to go. That is the intention, but they basically have very little legal leg to stand on.
Well, first of all, some sanctions that the West has imposed upon Russia are obviously designed to prevent Russia from developing and sustaining its military-industrial complex. Others are designed clearly to inflict severe damage on the Russian economy, irrespective of whether it's related to the military-industrial complex, and thereby bring hardship upon the Russian people, so that the theory being they will rise up against Vladimir Putin. And then there are some sanctions which are just straight-up censorship. And that's what this Valdai Club sanction is. It's just straight-up censorship. The Valdai Club isn't producing missiles. It isn't producing artillery shells. It isn't producing drones. It is a forum for discussion, and telling people that if they participate in that discussion with people from Russian society who are influential, and we're in a position where we are potentially going to find ourselves in World War III with Russia, that speaking to this people is a violation of the law, to my mind, is absurd. And it's extremely dangerous to say that the wise approach is to cut off all lines of communication, even at the level of academics, such as Radhika and Alan Freeman are. My God, I mean, this is just the most ridiculous form of censorship. And the second thing I want to say is, you know, Radhika, what she's been attacked for in the media is for asking President Putin a question about the two standing ovations given by the Parliament of Canada to a Ukrainian Nazi. And the claim in the CBC, the national taxpayer-funded broadcaster, was that Radhika's question permitted the Russian president to condemn Canada. Now, just stop and think about that for a second. Do we really think that Vladimir Putin needed anybody's permission to mock the Parliament of Canada for this disgraceful event where they gave two standing ovations to a Nazi. I mean, seriously? This is just an attempt to intimidate Radican Allen into not maintaining a professional academic discourse with people from the Russian intelligentsia. And that's dangerous. It's wrong. We should maintain lines of communication.
And I mean, bringing this back full circle, the United States and the European nations, states, should be communicating with Hamas. They should have been communicating with Hamas years ago, and they should be communicating with Hezbollah. They should have been years ago. That there are no individuals in the world, no forces, no political parties, state entities or non-state entities who pose a challenge or a threat potentially to the West, who we shouldn't be talking to, finding ways to talk to. I mean, that's the way you resolve conflict.
Absolutely. This is the most fundamental principle of diplomacy. You talk to your enemies. If your desire is ultimately to resolve conflict by peaceful means and minimize the suffering that violent conflict generates, you should never stop talking to your enemies. No matter how vigorously you may disagree, no matter how heinous you think they may be, because ultimately peace serves the collective interest more than war.
And, you know, I just want to go back to something. First of all, let me just say that, you know, there is actually, if the United States wants to talk to Hamas or Hezbollah, they can do so. Apparently, Qatar has always acted as an intermediary. But the point is, there is some really interesting sort of smoke and mirrors going on around here, because they, in fact, are talking to them. But anyway, the point that, what I'd like to make is actually return to a point that Dimitri made earlier. Because, you see, the real issue here is that we need a left. We need an anti-war, pro-developmental, anti-imperialist left, which unfortunately does not exist. And you know why we need it? Because what all these activities show us, what the West is and the US are doing in Ukraine, what they're doing in Gaza, Israel, etc., what all this shows us as well is that, quite frankly, if you think that the West knows what it's doing, that there's somebody in each one of these capitals that is somehow in command and going to a clearly identified goal, we are wrong. Actually, we are living under governments that are kind of increasingly out of control. And the point where they're going to lose their purchase on what's going on may not be far away. And when that point comes, if there is no left, guess who is going to be left picking up the pieces? It will be the right. And I think this is what we need to be afraid of, because essentially the paradigm of neoliberalism combined with tokenistic social liberalism, which has been essentially the ruling paradigm for the last many decades, is exhausted. It cannot solve our problems. It cannot solve the world's problems. It is continuously prone to war because it is essentially devoted to all those interests, including the interests of the military-industrial complex, which it is going to pursue whether or not it makes any sense in any national interest, however defined. These people are not any more politicians. They are, to go back to a word we were using earlier, only proxies for the most powerful corporate, financial, militarized interests in the land.
Dimitri, last comments, briefly, if you can.
I hope that we have drawn from this experience. This war is over, the Ukraine war. It has caused untold death and suffering. And I hope that we will all take the opportunity now and reflect upon the absolutely quintessential importance of always communicating with our friends and our enemies. If there's any lesson that we can draw from this for the benefit of humanity, that should be the lesson.
And also, it is not just a discussion. We also have to commit ourselves to what I have in other contexts called a pluripolar world, a world in which every country and every people has the right to chart their own destiny in whatever way they want, that it is not up to us to tell them what kind of political system they should have and what kind of economic system they should have. Because in the name of human rights and democracy, all we've been doing is imposing a one-size-fits-all neoliberalism whose only purpose is to open up these countries to imperial exploitation.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if the international institutions could be reformed, if the United Nations could be reformed, if the Security Council could be turned into a place where effective action could be taken to advance peace and security, rather than vetoing their proposal and then we veto their proposal.
Amen. I just said amen. That's all I had to add to that.
Yes. Well, and I just like to say that actually, you know, when we speak of reform, I think the reform is really trying to bring the United Nations back from the place where the United States has led it, where by starving UN agencies of funds, it has essentially made UN agencies prey to corporate interest and, of course, to American interest. But this is less working less and less. The original principles of the UN Charter, as the group of friends of the UN Charter has emphasized, which includes a whole lot of countries that the United States hates, as they have emphasized, the UN Charter is actually quite a good charter, and because it was written at a moment when the West's power was at its nadir. And they had to take account of both the communist world and the developing world in fashioning that charter. So I think that you could actually go back to the essential principles of that charter, which is equal sovereignty, non-aggression, peaceful coexistence, and all that. And I think it would be good. But the reason our governments cannot is because they are creatures, like I said, of big corporate interests, and they are slavishly so. And they do not see, they are essentially the fly in the ointment of a better working world.
This is truly the last question for Dimitri Lascaris. It seems to me that the one of the central problems in the world today, if not the central problem, is that international law has been rendered irrelevant, that international law is not the fundamental term of reference for state activities.
Yes, you've reminded me, David, of a critique that I have been articulating a great deal recently, and that is a critique of the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court has had some 20 years since it was brought into existence to indict one or more Israeli war criminals. It is absolutely crystal clear that the Israeli regime has committed an array of war crimes, not the least of which is the settlements, which are a slam dunk violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention and a war crime under the Rome Statute. And yet it has done absolutely nothing. Meanwhile, within, I think, 12 months of the start of the invasion in Ukraine, they indicted the ICC, a sitting president of the Russian Federation, for an alleged crime that it pales in comparison to the crimes that Israel is currently committing today. What has happened as a result of this is that the entire system of international justice has been brought into disrepute. A discriminatory system of justice, one that allows a certain category of wrongdoers impunity and another that prosecutes them with expedition, is not justice at all. It is simply a tool of imperialism. And at the end of the day, where we now are is that the international legal architecture has been completely discredited, in large part because of the ICC's flagrant double standard. And I think that what we need to do is we need to start all over again. We need to construct a new international adjudicator for violations of international law. Clearly, the ICC has failed, and it is more of a problem than a solution to the crisis of disregard for international law.
Dimitri Lascaris and Radhika Desai, thank you so much for this very exhilarating discussion on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you, David.
Thanks for having us.
Radhika Desai is professor in the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba. Dimitri Lascaris is a Canadian lawyer, journalist, and activist based in Montreal and Greece. This was just part of our conversation. Listen to all of it at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.